Hey, what's going on, everybody? It's John, Bam Bam the Dog. First, on behalf of both of us and everybody from the Real Ones team, I just want to sincerely thank you guys for tuning in. The folks that I bring on the show, they're family to me, and being able to tell their stories and bringing you into their world is something I'm just super proud of, and again, grateful that you guys tune in. We've decided we want to take things just a step further. We're going to introduce a Patreon community. And basically what that means is if you become part of this community, look, I already bored Bam Bam. If you want to become a part of this community, you're going to be able to hear episodes early and all that, ad-free and all that good stuff. But there's all this behind-the-scenes footage, all this stuff that we've shot that really brings you into the folks that we've had on the show, really brings you into their world. You're going to be able to do live chats with me and the folks that I bring on the show to talk about their world, talk about the issues that they're dealing with, about their triumphs and their tragedies. Just go to Patreon/RealOnes. This whole idea was something about building bridges and bringing people together and bringing folks that often don't get the mic and giving the mic to them. So the fact that you guys tune in means the world. Anyways, again, thank you. Be good to each other out there. Rock and roll. I'm gonna get a workout in a little bit with my man Eric Linden, you know, stunt coordinator from The Punisher. He's coming all the way up because we're about to get after it. And when that's done, he asked me in the car, are you gonna have my shake ready? And I know what that means. Am I gonna have my Sun Warrior shake? They've got the active protein, but they also have this collagen protein, which is amazing. They also have the Warrior blend, which is a little bit lighter if you're trying to cut. And I believe in it. I believe in that Sun Warrior stuff. Go to www.sunwarrior.com/realones for 15% off. I appreciate y'all.
In case you missed that from John, it's www.sunwarrior.com/realones. Use the code REALONES anywhere on the Sun Warrior site for 15% off the best plant proteins on the planet.
He's got that little tube of mace in his pocket all the time.
I saw that. Do you always carry mace with you?
Yeah.
And why is that your...
Because I don't want to use a gun.
And how do you feel about guns? Like, do you carry a gun?
In my synagogue, I used to carry a gun. I was the armed guy.
You were the armed guy?
Yeah.
Has your attitude towards guns or carrying guns on the street, has that changed at all? As you know, what's your sort of relationship with it?
I'm not exactly sure what you're asking.
I guess what I'm asking you is, I'll say for me personally, you know, we grew up in D.C. And, you know, when we were growing up, D.C., you know, people used to talk, you know, our basketball team was the Bullets. It had to be changed because we had such a horrible gun problem there. You grew up in Compton. I'm sure there was, you grew up with a horrible gun violence.
There were, actually, when I was there, it was almost all physical.
All physical, all hand to hand.
It was all, you know, or baseball bats, tree limbs. But
right.
There wasn't a lot of gun violence that was coming. That was after my time.
Got it. Well, you know, for us, I mean, I remember.
So you're younger than I remember.
Look, so yes, in the 90s and in the late
80s. I'm talking about the late 60s.
Sure. We went to a pretty good private school mm-hmm. in D.C., but you know, we had classmates that were shot and killed. There's no way you grew up in D.C. when you grew up and you didn't have people that were close to you that got shot and killed. So I always grew up pretty just adverse to guns. I never wanted anything to do with mm-hmm. them. And I always thought that they were sort of for punks and for cowards. Mm-hmm. But then really training in guns and in weapons, you know, for work and getting really proficient with it, I've kind of changed my mind on it a lot. And, you know, nowadays I just feel like there's so many of them. I've really changed my outlook. I was just wondering.
I don't have a complex, I mean, we had guns when I was growing up. My dad had a 30-06 and a 45. And, you know, we went out to the country, to the, you know, kind of, we call it in California, to the outback and went shooting. I had people shoot at me in high school, you know, but it never occurred to me to get a gun. It just occurred to me to be careful, you know, like. So I had friends get killed. It just never occurred to me to walk around with a gun when I was in high school.
Right.
So I was in the Marine Corps. You know, I was the high expert in my platoon, in my basic training platoon, you know, high marksman. Very comfortable with weapons, military weapons. And when I got out, I never went back to it. I got back to the 92 riots.
Huh.
I bought a little 22 because I used to be an expert in the Marine, so I got a little 22 to go shooting. And then during the riots, there was an attempted home invasion. And
at your house?
Yeah. My son got in trouble with some local guys, and I think they used the cover of the riots to get some payback or something. So they tried to, you know, four guys, but it's one doorway. So I was able to fight them off, and I thought I had this 22. I said, that 22 is not going to stop these people.
Right.
So then I said to my wife, I'm gonna have to get some more firepower. So then I started going down to the big five, and I thought, wow, I used to be like an expert, you know? So I got weapons because I like to shoot. So I don't have a complex relationship. I don't want to kill anybody, you know? So it's a real, listen, back in Compton, if I would have had a gun, there'd be a lot of dead bodies. And those guys grew up. I know them on Facebook now. I'm asking them on Facebook, what were you thinking about? They go, man, it was the times. Sorry, really sorry for my gang beating you up. But try to imagine those guys were dead now.
So having four people break into your house didn't
change? Well,
tried to.
Yeah.
Right. But you stopped them.
I stopped them at the doorway. Yeah. They didn't have guns either. But had they had guns, I would have been in trouble.
Well, they would have been in trouble.
True.
Yeah.
True. There have been four dead young kids, and who knows where they would have become as human beings. I'm glad I didn't have a gun that day.
Right.
It's just if they got past me with my wife and kids in the house, then I thought to myself, I can't let that happen.
You know. But we've kind of, you and I were just talking about this, we kind of crossed the Rubicon a little bit with some of the sort of situational, like, gun protection in the country. Because, you know, I was telling you, walking into a synagogue and seeing unarmed security guards in there now seems crazy to me in this day and age.
I understand it because the Jewish community tends to tack left on these issues. So there's a natural reticence for people bearing weapons. And sometimes the idea, you know, I'm not sure if it's true or not. I think it's not true, but gun presence increases gun violence. I don't believe that to be true, but there are people who sincerely believe it to be true. And I think they are onto one thing, that when people do see a security guard, let's say someone's going to, you know, hit a synagogue or another institution, seeing the security guard will make them go to the next place. So we had a security team that just had a jacket called security on the back of it. They stood outside the door of the synagogue. We had a camera. They had a wand. And I think if anybody drew by our synagogue, saw two guys with security jackets, they knew it's restricted access. Doors closed. You know, our security guys had to buzz them in. And then, so I think they would just go to the next place. So I think seeing a security guard was a good thing. Now, had they been armed, you both know how easy it is to disarm somebody if the gun's not in their hand. I mean, try to imagine three guys comes up, put them in a grip, pull that gun out of their holster. Now I got armed people who didn't used to be armed. So I just want to say it's a really complex thing.
Sure.
So here's one thing that we did. I trained a cadre of about 10 people for basic Krav Maga and Jiu-Jitsu, how to take someone down and how to attack an armed person. People didn't know this, but many of the decorations around our foyer were weapons. You know, I'm a black belt, so I could train anybody in the basics of self-defense by closing the distance, right? Breaking their posture, getting them on the ground without hurting them, you know? So that's the problem with like judo and boxing. You're gonna break someone's jaw, you're gonna break their spine. But what I like about the Greco-Roman side of BJJ is you close the distance, you adjust your body, you torque them, you break their posture, you lay them on the ground simply, you get them inside control. You know, you can do a Kimura, you can get anything out of their hands. So I much prefer that, if you're gonna have security, have a few people trained in BJJ. That would be my first preference before you put someone with a gun on the sidewalk, because it is not that hard to take a gun away from somebody.
And we've had a lot of folks from law enforcement on the show, you know, both from South Central, from Newton Division, and then, you know, also Baltimore, Louisiana, Shreveport. That's sort of a recurring theme. It's just,
what do they say? I mean, do they think armed is the norm? It's just,
well, look, culturally, I mean, look, you go down to Shreveport and, you know, any nurse that you see walking home from, I mean, you just, thanks, brother. You've got to assume every single person is armed. And I think that folks down there, you know, truly believe that you're just safer that way. And, you know, like you said, it's incredibly nuanced and it's, you know.
Listen, if I live down there, but remember, I live in Sherman Oaks. And my commute is from, you know, one part of my house to the other.
Sure.
And I go to my jiu-jitsu club and we go out to dinner. Now, if I worked in a rough neighborhood and had to walk from here to my car, let's say in a dark carport, I would probably want to carry a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
But I better know how to use it.
Right.
You know, if you know how to get it out on target and use it within the law. Because if you hesitate and someone closes the distance, then...
Well, I think that's a big, I mean, that's a big issue that I found, you know, growing up in a pretty liberal and progressive city and pretty liberal, progressive environment. I feel like a lot of the people who, like you said, a lot of the people who have these very anti-gun views mm-hmm. have never touched a gun, never held a gun, really right. have no familiarity or understanding of how right. they work. Right. And, you could argue that's ignorance, and you could argue that, you know, any sort of fear that's based on ignorance isn't always, I would rather listen to somebody who's proficient, really understands it, and then is deciding not to use it or can speak against it.
Well, that's a general, I mean, one thing I teach is wisdom. And one thing I say, you know, there are like several areas of wisdom, but one is if you care about something enough to utter an opinion, know what you're talking about.
That's it.
So I don't mind that people have differing views,
sure.
but it ought to be an informed view.
Sure.
When people say I'm anti-gun, I say, I don't even know what that means. Like, you'll notice I'm asking you, like, what exactly do you mean? Can you right. define it? Because I don't assume that I know what anybody is talking about until I find out what they're talking about.
Sure,
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, so we're having an informed conversation right here. Yeah.
I guess where I was saying with the law enforcement that I've talked to that really echo what you were talking about was really just the BJJ stuff.
Yeah.
It's just that,
yeah.
you know, just the difference. It's what we talked about when we first walked in, the difference between actually striking someone. You know, if you're hitting somebody with a stick or you're hitting somebody, a suspect who's scared,
yeah.
it's going to cause them to try to defend themselves and fight back. But if you can get right up and close to somebody, put them into some sort of submission or some sort of hold that where you can be close to them, you can talk to them, you can talk them down. Right. They found, I think it was Henzo Gracie was doing a program with police departments across the country. Really,
I love his stuff.
Yeah,
he's great. And I also on my feed I have street violence. I like to look how street fights go down. So part of that is police violence. And I would say in 90% of the cases that I'm seeing with my own eyes, if that police officer had known some form of grappling or BJJ, people would not have got shot.
And can you explain why you think that is?
Well, so when a person starts to confront, they stand back and pull their weapon. And they start shouting at the person.
Right.
And the person, I think people get discombobulated. They're not exactly sure what to do.
Sure.
And then when they say get on the ground, I think people have panic attacks. That they're going to have their hands put behind their back. They're, you know, and people freak out. And they shout a couple more times and someone pulls a weapon. And I think to myself, if someone started getting rousty, you walk up to them and say, look, you know, like pray your hands. You always walk up with prayer hands because prayer hands go to fight hands in a tenth of a second, right? You pray your hands, look, man, I don't want this to escalate. So let's start all over again, calm, right? And you got your fight hands in a second. They go for a fight hand, you right away do do a Russian tie up or you got so many things you can do if someone moves their hands, but you don't have to stand back and draw. So if somebody were really proficient
yep.
in, you know, kind of the Greco-Roman side of grappling, you know, with a standing opponent, it is so easy to immobilize somebody and just gently sit them down.
And if you're training every day and you're used to having your hands on people and being up close,
right.
you're probably not going to be speaking in a louder octave. You're probably not going to be freaking out.
That's our first training. As you know, like you train BJJ, the first thing you learn in fight class is de-escalation. If you don't know how to de-escalate, you should not be training. And the first part of de-escalation is prayer hands. You know, it's like de-escalation. Hey, can we just calm this down? Because this goes right to, you know, your guard, goes right to, you know, Russian, either a wizard or a Russian tie-up or something. So you got to train how to go from prayer hands to immobilizing hands.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But the first thing is de-escalation. We want to hurt anybody.
But this is complicated, right? Because at the same time, you know, most of the cops that you've had on and talked to, I think almost none of them would say that unfettered access to guns is a good thing, because what it's driven is this assumption that everybody is armed. So even if you know how to de-escalate, if you assume that everybody you're confronting has a weapon, I think by nature you react a little bit differently. But we don't really do nuance in this country anymore. We do one side or the other. And the truth is, like, I think most of the cops that we've ever spoken to would say, like, they wish there were fewer guns on the street.
For sure.
Almost to a T.
Which may be an unconscious reason I don't want to carry one, because if I ever got into confrontation, that's really scary for a police officer. So, look, I'm not an expert on what police think and what the right thing is. All I can tell you is when I see something and I see a police officer escalate and then it escalates to a bad place. Now, you're right. I'm not the guy when I pull somebody over or they get out of their car that has to wonder if they have a gun. Now, I'm not that guy. I'm not an expert in it. So I would defer to their judgment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you drove in today, when you drove in your truck, you know, and you pulled up, I saw in your rear window, I think I saw you had a Marine Corps sticker, right? And you have a sticker, what is that, of your academy, of your jiu-jitsu academy?
Yeah, exactly.
And I heard you on a podcast, and I got to, your name came to me through Jamie Petrikoff. Right. And now, you know, I'm an actor, he's a producer, and, you know, we sat down, typical kind of Hollywood meeting, and normally these meetings are about what movie he's doing, what movies I'm doing, you know, who we know in common, how we can maybe work together. But as soon as he and I sat down, we immediately got into family. We started talking about kids, relationships, and I immediately was very fond of him. And he told me to look into you, and I was really, really glad that I did. But you know, the way he described you was, the first thing he said is, you know, he's a rabbi, but he's also from Compton.
Yeah.
He's a black belt in jiu-jitsu, and he's a Marine.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could just sort of dig into what that "but" is about, and sure, and what that means.
Well, remember, there are accidents in life, and there are intentions in life.
Right? Yes, sir.
All right. So I spent my first, I think, 9 years out in Anaheim, GI Bill. My dad's a veteran, you know, got a job as a machinist at Western Gear Corporation in Linwood. They got what they could afford in Anaheim. So my dad drove up the Santa Ana Freeway, you know, to work every day. And then they got a little money behind them, and they said, let's move it on up. So in 1964, Compton was an upper middle class town, you know, palm tree lined streets. I mean, really a beautiful place.
So Duke Snyder's from?
One of the Bush, I think George Bush grew up in Compton for a while. Yeah. So there's a lot of people, you know, you look back in the 40s, 50s, early 60s, you know, Compton was a, you know, really good, safe place to live for blacks, Hispanics, and whites. It was simply upper middle class. Watts riots hit in 65. And I remember seeing National Guard trucks driving down our street. And it suddenly became dangerous. You know, there was you know, I remember when I was watching the riots on television. So we were watching the riots on TV, and then could see the smoke in the helicopters. You know, we go outside and see it.
Yeah.
And then I saw people yelling, "Get Whitey!" And
That on TV. You heard it out the window.
No. It was we were in Compton. It was in Watts.
Got it.
It was a good half mile away.
Got it.
But I saw the rioters, and then I think I even saw a sign. So I asked my father, "Who's Whitey?" I thought they were after some kind of racist, you know, Ku Klux Klan guy, right?
Yeah.
My dad says, "You're Whitey." I said, "What did I do?" I was completely clueless, right? Because I grew up in a very left-wing home. You know, I mean, completely pro what I'll call the liberal agenda of the 50s and 60s. You know, Stevenson Democrats, Kennedy Democrats, Johnson Democrats. I worked on Robert Kennedy's election in Compton. You know, I used to go door to door. And the idea that people hated me because of my race, it was contrary to everything I'd been taught. Because I thought the only race haters were white Southerners. I did not know that black people could be race haters. Okay. So there was a white flight. You know, the closer you were to the Watts riots, the more people fled Compton.
Right.
And so then when a few years got to our neighborhood, and then it just got brutal. You know, it was, no one was prepared for it. I mean, especially my black neighbors. I married many black neighbors. My best friends were actually all black, Hispanic. I had one guy. They weren't prepared for the amount of violence that started moving in from East Compton and Watts. So that was an accident of history. You know, I didn't mean for that to happen. And my parents, on the other hand, said, you know, we're good democratic liberals. We will not move because our neighborhood is going black. We're not joining the white flight. So we stayed until the last possible moment. And that was my parents' choice. But then my experience of violence skyrocketed. You know, and I was mentioning to Gareth before, I learned how to fight multiple attackers, you know, when I was in junior high school, right? Because it was almost always multiple attackers. And so we had to leave. I mean, I think, honestly, my life and our family's lives were in danger. So we moved to the next over middle class communities where I went to high school, and you know, it was kind of a at times rough middle class environment that was surrounded by, on one side, by Compton, Watts, and then Southgate, Huntington Park, and then the 710 freeway. So it was like, you know, there was like border stuff. And now at the same time, we belonged to a synagogue and I really liked it. So people say, you didn't hate Hebrew school? I said, I liked Hebrew school because for me, Hebrew school wasn't being out on the street. Mm. You know, I was around nice people who talked about thoughtful things. That was like an oasis for me. So I always loved my synagogue, loved the rabbi, loved the Hebrew school. And when I was in 11th grade, a spiritual teacher found me. You know, my science teacher turned out to be a mystic. And he was always on the lookout for spiritual students. I mean, it's a story I can go into if you're interested, but sure. That happened when I was in 11th grade.
Well, one question for you, because
sure.
I always find as we get older, like the totality of our childhood experience kind of blends together.
Right.
Like I have trouble picking out little moments and remembering when they actually happened, if right. they actually happened the way mm-hmm. I think that they did.
Yeah.
But you have this like totality of a feeling that you mm-hmm. had when you were growing up. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, just because of the like polarity and what you just talked about, like mm-hmm. when you think about your childhood now, how do you remember it? How do you define that phase of your life?
I've had to talk about it a lot. And I've also gotten in touch with a few of my, because of Facebook, friends from Compton and Linwood, and I reviewed stuff with them because I want to make sure that my memories were real. So my feeling tone in Compton, I think, first of all, was I had really good friends. We really had fun. Now I can rattle off their names to you, tell you fun stuff we did. The second thing was the fear. I mean, there really was a fear everywhere I went. Third, family life. You know, just, you know, the older you get, the less you're around your family. But I remember my family life very well. You know, we had dogs and my dad was a kind of cool, crazy guy. And I just remember all kinds of stuff that he used to do. I tell my father stories and they're objectively really funny. You know, I remember in the Jewish life, I really remember going to synagogue and feeling safe. I just remember the physical feeling, I'm safe here. I remember my bar mitzvah. So yeah, I have very vivid memories. So I would say it's mixed. I would say the totality of it was, I was reflective. So I reflected on the violence. I think I knew it was happening. I mean, I never became anti-black. I knew it wasn't about black and white, it was about something else. It was about maybe what we call today, the residue of violence against blacks, which left an imprint in the culture, what led to maybe what I'll call an instinctive hatred of white people. It wasn't about me, because every black person I ever met liked me, right? So ones that I didn't meet. So I never assumed that it was personal.
But the bulk of the sort of violence that you encountered, you feel like it was racially based?
Well, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was you getting jumped for being
white? Yeah, they would introduce it that way. I mean, I don't want to say what they said, but it was very clearly, we're going to hurt you because you're white. Mm-hmm. Now yeah. let's go.
Your dad told you it was coming.
Well, that was in 65.
Yeah.
The first time I got jumped in 66, some guys came up and asked me for money. So, of course I'll give you money. I mean, why wouldn't I give you money? It's like, because, you know, that's like we help out people. And then when he punched me in the jaw after I gave him the money, I thought, I did not see that coming. Like, what? And then it came the white tirade. You know, so my best friends were black and they were outraged by it. And they wanted to hunt those guys out. I mean, there were things when just, let me share with you one narrative.
Please.
As things got bad at Roosevelt Junior High School on Alondra Boulevard in Compton, they had this thing called a free-for-all. Where someone yells free-for-all, everybody starts swinging. And then I saw one day, I was in the middle of too many of these free-for-alls. And I was getting bloodied. And I couldn't get out. And I saw a girl talking to her friend, and one says, what's going on? She says, well, they're after that white boy. And she's pointing at me. I said, well, I'm in trouble. So I had to get out of there. So I found my friend Daniel Lee. And Daniel said, don't worry, I'll walk you out. So we go outside to the exit. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that there were 50 to 100 kids there waiting for me. Because this thing snowballed. And Daniel Lee, we're both in eighth grade, and he and I would fight. He had big knuckles. I just remember Daniel Lee, man. You saw those knuckles coming, it looked like a bowling ball, right? So Daniel Lee said, following, he says, if you want to get to Finley, you've got to go through me.
That's beautiful.
Put his arm around me and walked me home. Those are my friends. So my friends would fight for me. When there's a group of guys on the next street over one block down, and they said, they decided we're going to ambush them. You stay on the street, we'll hide. They showed up. My friends like showed up to hurt them, and they said, okay, truce. And we sat down, and my friend said, this guy, what's going on, man? Why are you after Finley? Well, because I was in Georgia and these white, yeah, but that's not Finley. And we just had a truce. So, see, I can't think about the experience, but think about the loyalty of friends. Like it's not, maybe an exaggeration, but I think Daniel Lee put his life on the line that day.
Going back to the Jamie Butt question, not Jamie's butt, but the butt that. Right.
But I inferred that.
Right? I appreciate it. But so can you just continue to walk me through that?
All right.
So why that is?
I had the spiritual teacher who, look, I was already thoughtful. I read, I knew all about World War II. You know, I was one of those guys. Like, the background of every man that I knew was everybody was in World War II or Korea. So I just had to know about that. So then one thing that happened was, my older sister, when she was in college, she took philosophy classes, and then she left for Europe, and I was left with her library. So I was reading Camus and Sartre, Nietzsche, when I was in ninth grade. I just picked up the paperback. I just remember having this thought, wow, like there's a whole other world out there. So like I got the Jewish thing. I got Jewish history, therefore European history, U.S. history, values, ethics. I got all that pretty well down. A good religious school education. But when I discovered that there are people who thought about a world, like a metaphysical world, like the human condition, that was so profoundly real, that's what they saw, that's what they felt. And I said, it's not empirically real, but it's real. So I began a spiritual search, ninth grade, 10th grade. So in 11th grade, when this spiritual teacher, a high school teacher, in a way inducted me, I was ready. So we met weekly in his classroom after school about if you know the word, he was a student of the great teacher Gurdjieff, who has headed a mystical school in Europe, came to the States. He died in 1949, but he left from the perspective of mystical schools in those days, it was big and well known. It was eclipsed, of course, in the 60s. So he was real trained in this, and he wanted to bring me into the world of Gurdjieff, which was a pretty profound and deep mystical school. So while I was going through high school, I had this sense of, you talk about the sense of worlds, that I lived in one world, but I was a citizen of another. I think Santayana said that, meaning, yeah, this is Linwood, but all my studies and Jack Bishop said, but there's another world that's more real than this one. And which one do you belong to? And I just realized I wanted to be in that second world. That was the real. That was the real world. World of spirit, soul, the depth of human connection, consciousness, spirit. I mean, that just felt so real to me. And I knew I wasn't ready. So when of the many reasons I joined the Marines was for that. I had to clean up.
What does that mean, clean up?
Girls, violence, drugs, hanging out, wasting time, procrastination, being dissolute, not taking the gifts that God gave me seriously. I just felt I don't deserve the gifts that God gave me because I'm not living up to them. I could feel that if I wanted to live up to the gifts that I was given, I had to get out of there.
And the Marine Corps would cleanse that. You come from a military family, so you had some awareness, but like, was it the regiment? Was it the discipline?
Yeah, my dad was in World War II, but he was anti-military. You know, he was a strong leftist, so he did not like the military. He never got past private. He kept getting busted back down. I had a brother-in-law who was in the Marines, and he got me into the pride of the Corps thing. But it was more that I needed the GI Bill, number one. Number two, I'm a patriot. I really am a patriot. I love our country. I love our country because of the journey that we're on. I'm not proud of the stains on our past, but I believe the journey's in the right direction. And what I heard about boot camp, it sounded like an Indian ashram. You can't talk. They shave your head. And you suffer every waking moment. And I thought, in 18 years old, looking at it, I thought to myself, I don't know why it was so clear to me, but I remember when I wanted to enlist, I went down to the Army and they said, oh, we have beer machines in the barracks. I said, that's not what I want. Yeah. You know, Air Force, yeah, you can work on your college degree while you're in boot camp. I said, that's not it. I went to the Marine Corps. They said, no, we will kick your ass from morning till night and you will not take in any classes and you'll not have a sip of beer and you won't be able to say your first name. I said, sign me up.
Yep, yep.
Right. So I just, I had a knowledge that I didn't deserve when I was 18, but it gave me everything I wanted.
But the North Light was still this sort of higher, this sort of religious or at least metaphysical.
I would say for me, the Jewish religion had almost nothing to do with this. Yep. The Jewish religion, it was a good holding place, but the real thing was the spiritual. And yeah, so boot camp gave me that. The interesting thing is one of my drill instructors was one of those people. So I went from one spiritual fellowship into another.
He was one of what kind of people?
Jack Bishop. He was a spiritual guy. He was, everything that happened in boot camp happened at two levels. Okay?
How so?
Well, first of all, he selected, and by the way, I'm not the only one who went in the Marines on a spiritual quest. We called them the Percys and the Johnnies.
The Percys and the Johnnies?
Yeah. So the Johnnies were the guys who, I want to be a Marine, you know, like, I want to wear the Eagle Globe and Anchor.
Yeah.
And the Percys were, I'm on a spiritual quest and the Marine Corps will give me what I need.
And what would you say the ratio is there in your day?
10 to 15%.
Got it.
I mean, we could recognize each other.
Got it.
You know, and my Sergeant Throneberry could recognize us because he would say something. And one time, like, so we're at the chow hall and he comes out and, you know, you like 80 guys in each platoon. So you got to wait your turns an airport. You can't have all the platoons marching at the same time. So we're waiting for the other platoons move off and he looks at us, screams at us and says, you think just because we're in line to go back to the barracks that you get to sit here? He says, you're going to drill now. We didn't have our weapons with us.
Right.
He said, I drilled another platoon to death. They are a ghost platoon and their weapons are at your feet. Everybody pick up your rifle. So guys are looking around, I go, oh, this is great.
Exactly I'm what loving you're looking
this.
For.
So I pick up my rifle, stand up forward arms. And then all the guys, so we all look around, so we have, and he says, does everybody have the correct rifle? So look, I said, sir, this private doesn't. So he's looking and he's like smiling between his demeanor. He says, who in the hell has Private Finley's rifle? So one of the other guys goes, sir, this private does. And he goes, would you please give Private Finley his rifle? So we exchange rifles. Then we do like close order drill with imaginary weapons. And yeah, we live in a metaphysical world. There are things here that we don't see. And so as we went through boot camp, you know, he was playing with us. And the guys who could see it saw it. And the guys who didn't, it felt like boot camp. But for me, it always felt like this incredibly complex world of imagination.
Was your time in Compton and your childhood and the violence that you encountered, and just your life period, and then your time in the Marine Corps, I understand your sort of internal Jewish identity, but how about outwardly? You know, in the violence and the shit that you were taking from people, did Judaism play any part? Did Judaism take any part? Was your Jewishness known in the Corps?
The second answer, yes. You know, when I was the highest high expert in my platoon, there was a guy who was envious of me. And I had a stripe and we were outside the chow hall going back. And if we goof off and talk, we end up doing endless push-ups. So I said, hey guy, and you said, hey, everybody fall in. And he started off, you know, blah, blah, Jewish, blah, 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 blah. Don't tell me, blah, 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 blah. And I thought to myself, wow, man, this is it. Now this is a private, right? So the whole platoon gets around us. And I thought to myself, for these 80 guys, they're definite. This is how I thought. I'm not saying it's right, just how I thought. Their definition of a Jew is going to be formed right now.
That's right.
And so is that guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I launched on him. Mm-hmm. Right, got him on the ground, pounding him. They pulled me off. The drill instructor came along who got transferred in. He's a black guy named Simmons. He said, what happened? Well, McKelvey mouthed off to Private Finley and Private Finley jumped on and beat him up. Okay, Finley, get back to the dude. You're going to jail. He says, sir, yes, sir. So I go to the barracks, I pack my sea bag, I go into his duty's office, and he says, did you attack Private McKelvey?
The same sergeant, this
black
sergeant.
Yeah, the same sergeant who came out, yeah. So I said, yes, sir. He said, you're going to jail. Yes, sir. That's what you're supposed to say. He says, so what happened? Sir, no excuse, sir. So he liked that. He said, okay, well, really what happened? I said, Private McKelvin called me a dirty Jew, blah, blah, blah. And he said, he looked at me and said, why didn't you kill that cracker so-and-so? I said, sir, the other privates held my hands behind me, sir. And, sir, I couldn't finish, sir. He said, well, next time you kill him. I said, sir, yes, sir. He says, get back to your, get back to the barracks. So if he wouldn't have been black, you know, if he would have been one of the other guys that maybe identified with Private McKelvin more than me, I don't know. But
did you feel like, though, in that moment that those guys all had prior thoughts about Jewish people, or that was truly like their first exposure and you were setting a tone?
That's a great question. I would say almost entirely the second, which means it, in places like the Marine Corps, you are judged on your proficiency. Are you a good Marine? So I was a very good Marine. And so they only judged me on that. Now, there are other things that I think were more, this is Sergeant Throneberry. So there's another Jewish guy in the platoon next door. And I heard him with a fake argument with that sergeant. My Jew can kick the crap out of your Jew. So they brought us over to fight each other. His name was...
Who was the tougher Jew?
Oh, I won, I'm glad to say.
Yeah.
His name was Warren Traub. And we looked at each other and we'll say, we're going to keep this... So we fought in a manner of speaking. But I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
Right, because that's just the kind of stuff they did. But there was no anti-Jewishness at any level, except there were occasional people, okay? So there was not the institution of the Marine Corps. Marine Corps was, I think, exceptionally pro-religion. Because another adage we heard, a religious Marine is a better Marine.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever your religion is, practice your religion, you will be a better Marine. And it went around the board. No one ever interfered with my Jewish practice. It was completely encouraged. So I would say religiously it was a positive experience.
I think there's something that's really fascinating to me, that this sort of like Jewish hatred or when it did manifest itself in that one guy whose ass you whooped, it was because he was jealous or
I think that's what it was.
And do you think so often a lot of these, you know, whether it's racial or religious hatred, comes out of something else? It manifests itself because there's actually something else going on?
You know, I taught the Holocaust class at USC for 10 years. So hatred of Jews is an extremely complex thing. Unfortunately, it's in the New Testament, in John chapter 8. It's a trope in Christian religiosity that, you know...
How is it in John 8?
Oh, where... I don't think this is Jesus talking, but the writer of John says to the Jews who say, we're children of Abraham, he says, no, you're children of Satan. Because if you don't accept me, I don't believe this is Jesus talking, it's whoever put these words in his mouth. He says, if you don't believe me, you're the children of Satan. And then when you have in two of the Gospels, you have the trial of Jesus, and the Jews say, you know, all the Jews say, crucify him. And I think to myself, Jews have never had one opinion, right? So if they would have said a third of the Jews, you know, some said yes, some said no, some said maybe, some said I'll think about it later. If they said all the Jews said it, I said, I'm not taking that, right? So clearly it's a trope.
Mm-hmm.
So two of the Gospels say the Jews said crucify him. But the trial of Jesus is not in every Gospel. And then when you have the Pharisees who are meeting on the night of Passover. Well, Jewish courts don't meet on the night of Passover. So when I read the New Testament in high school, I mean, I realized, oh, so this is a setup. There's some animosity here. So I think it's in the New Testament. Most Christians don't even know this. They don't know that it's there. And when they read it, they say, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. Please forgive us. But it was stacked into Christianity. And then during different times in different countries, that almost unknown teaching comes to the foreground. So why is there Jew hatred? Who does it? Under what conditions? It is so complex. I really fear to give you, I mean, unless you want to turn this into that class, I'm happy to do it. But let me just say it's complex. And when I sit down with someone who thinks those things and we talk, within about 15 minutes, they say, okay, that was foolish. I take it all back.
That's something you do regularly. Kinds of people out.
I used to
can
do
you give
it.
Me
no,
an
no,
example?
they would talk, and I would say, "Hey, can I have a minute of your time?"
Uh-huh.
And when they would say, "Jewish bankers," I said, "How many Jews own banks? What percentages are we talking about of Jews who own banks?" They said, "Well, most owners of banks are Jewish." I said, "Can you give me any evidence for that?" "Well, no." I said, "And if there were, how many banks are in America that are like not the branch, but are owned by a Jewish family?" Now, how many Jews are there in the world? So we talk about 0.00001%. So tell me something about Jews. Well, they're greedy. I said, does that mean they charge more than you want to pay? Because I'd love to hear what you mean by greed. So we start talking. They go, you know, I actually have never thought about it. So I would rather I would rather not defend this position. You know, like, I mean, I'm sad to say when people say, like, the Jews run Hollywood. I said, yeah, there's a lot of Jewish people in the film industry. I think they're actually competing with each other. They don't own it in unison. It just happened that, you know, when Jews immigrated, many of them went into the, you know, arts and entertainment and men congregated in Hollywood. And, you know, it was a kind of a Jewish thing. Now, the question is, why did so many Jews in Russia, Eastern Europe, when they came here, go to Hollywood and start producing movies? That's a great question. I can answer it. But it's not as if there was a cabal in Russia right. where these utterly penurious Jews in the shtetl sat around and said, I have an idea. Let's go to America, go to Hollywood. You know, it's just, it just beggars the imagination.
But I get that it's complex, but it's also, there's like elements of it that are super simple too, right? I mean, at the end of the day, like, Jewish bigotry has always been based on the belief that Jews are in some way, shape, or form a threat. Right. And other forms of bigotry are not like that. Other mm-hmm. forms of bigotry are about making people subservient or less intelligent or less capable. But anti-Semitism has always kind of been the opposite. Right. It's always been about portraying Jewish people as having this unique capacity to threaten. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be something that's as old as time.
Let's say that accounts for some degree of it. OK, the idea of the super competent Jew who didn't get there on merit. So that might come down to envy. And then the idea that they're in cahoots with each other. Okay. Now, for me, when people say that, it's just an expression of powerlessness. All conspiracy theories is a sense that somebody else is in power, there's something going on, and I'm the victim of it. So when I hear, like, the conspiracy theory of white people, that there's a white conspiracy against black people, you go to other countries where there aren't Jews and whites, it's a different conspiracy. So conspiracy theories are worldwide. In the West, there is this sense of the Jews, but why the Jews? Okay. So you have to go back to the New Testament, I think. Well, they're the children of Satan, and they killed Jesus. Well, that's a starting point. And then it's fill in the blanks. So it has to do, I think, with the beginning of anti-Judaism in the New Testament. The Jew as the outsider, the foreigner. Because if you go to China, you go to Vietnam, you go to other places, they still have the usual suspect. Mm-hmm. It's just not a Jew. It's some other ethnic group. So in every culture, there's an ethnic group, which is the enemy. You know, when I was in Israel one summer, you could get Lebanese TV. And they would put English subtitles, if I'm not mistaken. So I see a debate on Lebanese television. And one guy says, they're arguing bitterly. Shiite and a Sunni. So the Sunni says, I would rather my daughter marry a Zionist than a Shiite dog like you. Wow. So you go to some parts, you know, you look at ISIS, they went on a genocidal mission to murder Shiites. In every, look at the genocide in Rwanda, where it was the Houthis versus the Tutsis. So yes, I mean, we're very sensitive about it here. There's a lot written about it. It might have to be with the idea, well, there's a conspiracy and there's somebody in charge, and you talk about it for a few months. And unless they're really addicted to conspiracy theory, they're typically willing to be talked out about it. Because people, again, unless they're addicted to a conspiracy theory, they actually do want to be rational, and they don't want to be seen as not being able to string three thoughts together. But there are people who are just addicted to conspiracy theories. It doesn't matter what you say. So we Jews have been the victims of this conspiracy theory. It's coming up again, I think, because a few people got away with it, and kind of like the rocks get turned over and, you know, the cockroaches come out. And, you know, I hate anybody who is racist or bigoted in any way whatsoever. Now, do I feel in more danger, for example? You know, one thing I don't want to do is extrapolate from a few things. See, when you if there were a synagogue attacked coming up. Well, there have been synagogue attacks before this.
Right.
Are they going to significantly go up? is someone going to shout at somebody? We're going to call that a hate crime? I'm so leery of reading headlines and things like that, you know, to fill in the news gap on what's going on in America today. You know, when I was a student rabbi in Boise, Idaho, I used to fly up once a month. And someone put a bomb under one of the synagogue floors, and it blew up in the middle of the night when the Hebrew school wasn't there. Well, the whole state of Idaho took it very seriously. This is in Boise. The federal government took it seriously. So one Looney Tune from eastern Idaho, you know, puts a bomb under the floor that just basically buckled the floor. So now, like, the rise of violent anti-Semitism in Idaho. So I thought, I don't know. It's like one guy, I don't know. Like, let's see what happens next. I think about it. I was ready to predict my synagogue when the time came. Somebody found a swastika painted on Venice Boulevard. So I don't know what that means. It's one person. I don't know what it means. So what you're hearing from me is a kind of a humility about all this. I'm not alarmist. I don't want people walking out around in fear if it's not there. If you have fear, take care of it. You know, learn some martial arts, mm-hmm. you know, have 360 awareness. But let's not all increase our fear level, because I don't think that does anybody any good to live in disproportionate fear. It's better to think about fear rationally and what you're going to do about it.
Do you talk to your congregation about that?
Sure. Yeah. Once a month, we had a training on intruder training. And I reminded people living in the corner by the door, if there are intruders, you have a choice to make. You want to get shot in the back or shot in the chest? You have a basic choice to make. Because if you run, you will get shot in the back. If you all attack, only two people get shot in the chest. So anybody who's sitting by that back door, I remind them every month, if you sit by the back door, you have a choice. They will all go, absolutely.
But I mean about the irrationality of fear too, right? Because it's like—
Oh, yeah, thank you. This goes back to the parenting thing, that the inner life management. You know, I look at our what I call negative ego states, and there's a whole array of them. Anger, resentment, fear, envy, victimhood, et cetera. There's about 20 what I call negative ego states that plague people. Either they plague them interpersonally, or they're inner aggressive. Anxiety, fear, shame, worthlessness, et cetera. So they attack the self. Even the self-attacking ones are very disruptive of interpersonal relationships. So very early on, I really wanted to understand regulating the inner life. And I also learned early on, without recourse to traditional talking psychotherapy, for some people it works great to talk about your past. For other people, it locks in those neurological patterns. Hmm. So I've decided, take on negative ego states as something to take on. In Jewish spiritual psychology, we call it the Yetzer Hara, a destructive shape within you. So because of my interest in what we call shadow work, which means like the Jungian idea that everybody has a shadow, these shadows get manifested in these negative ego states. I teach a practice where you want to be aware of them, watch how they operate, and go after them. Hmm. So it's a spiritual warrior kind of a thing. So I don't want to wait until a symptom hits and takes over a part of my day or damages a relationship. I recommend going after them proactively with the higher self working on disruptive ego states.
Can you give us an example?
Well, let's say anger. Number one, I think a big part of angry people are it's genetic and personality. Some people just run hot. Other people run defensive. Let's say we're just going to take these two archetypes. Angry people are super sensitive to being let down, to being disappointed, to not being able to control others, control situations, trying to manage outcomes, dominate other people. And when that happens, they feel like at a primal level a threat, and they need to take care of the threat. So one way is anger. And even without anger, there's, I call it the four C's: criticizing, complaining, condemning, insulting, labeling, blaming, accusing, and then escalating conflict. So when I first began counseling people, I thought, whatever this thing is, you know, because it manifests in anger or criticizing, complaining, condemning, et cetera, it's not what the other person did, because it's almost all disproportionate. And secondly, if it is about what they did, that's a guaranteed wrong way to change people. Unless you have overwhelming coercive power, most people don't transform under insult. In fact, what you oftentimes get is defiance and pushback. So let's say a person says, well, you wouldn't believe what my spouse said, you wouldn't believe what my teenager did. I said, I believe everything. I'm gonna ask you, rationally speaking, is criticizing your spouse going to make them more likely to meet their, your needs? I will venture to guess that a criticized spouse will meet fewer of your needs than a spouse who's not criticized.
So what do you do?
Ah, it's not the spouse, it's the ego state.
Right.
There's a shadow force in there that wants to unleash on other people. Okay, so you got to fight the anger. What you don't do is, well, my father, my mother, it might work with some people, but you have to proactively go to what I call the higher self, go down and work with the ego state. So what I found is disruptive ego states all have a, look, they begin as a feeling, but at some level, all feelings have thoughts. Okay? So when I say, explain to me the thought behind criticism, assuming there is one, well, I have to correct them. That's a rational thought. I have to correct them. It's not true, but at least it makes sense in the English language. They can't get away with this. There's always some thought there. I say, okay, well, let's examine those thoughts. Okay? Now, this is an interesting thing. You go to a higher self where we have the ability to observe, the ability to be objective about our inner lives, the ability to be rational, to aim at the truth. So everything in here is activated and brought to bear against the ego state of anger. And the ego state of anger just withers. It cannot stand this investigation. So let's say, okay, you're right. It will not make things better. It's making everything worse. My anger makes everything worse. It makes me sick. It makes them sick. And it's so destructive. I say, oh, great. So there's no reason. So tell me why the anger gets out. They said, I don't know. But does that sound reasonable? But people in the end will say, I don't know. You're right. It's thoughtless. It's destructive. I don't know. I said, now you need to listen very carefully because you haven't decided. You haven't decided to stop being destructive. I said, I guarantee you this. They say, well, you wouldn't believe what they say. I said, I lived in San Diego for 3 months where these four guys insulted me every single day. And I never got mad once.
About what? What were they insulting you?
That I didn't hold my rifle correctly. That I didn't run fast enough.
Okay.
Yeah. These four guys. 3 months straight, beating me, insulting me, smacking me around. I never said, listen here, sir, right? I need to.
How dare you?
How dare you? Right? Yeah. Never occurred to me.
Yeah.
So anger is not a response to what someone does.
Right.
It's a response to what you think you can do.
Right.
So they said, okay, how do I stop? So this is where I talk about the wall of virtue. You need to make a decision. It's a decision. Like when anger comes, it hits a wall. I'm saying no to my anger. And there are people that can say, you're 100% right. I'll train myself on my own time. This is what I call my wisdom practice. I will go down inside. I will discover my negative ego states. I will reason with them. I will discover what the righteous path is, what the honor code is. And whenever I have an urge to break the honor code, I will have a wall of virtue that says no. And first thing it does, it hits the wall of virtue. Doesn't matter what I feel. Doesn't matter what I think. I have an honor code. Okay. Then people say, well, isn't that repression? I said, it's called restraint. Now you have to work through the impulse to break your honor code. But I have an honor code first. I'm not going to say, well, I haven't thought it through, so I don't have to live by an honor code. Mm-hmm, but that doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. Go find another teacher. Because if a person, I don't mind if people fail the honor code. But they have to commit to the honor code. Mm-hmm. So once a person commits to the honor code, I say, I can help you. Because you're in a fight for what kind of person you want to be. An honorable person, or a person who lacks restraint, lacks honor, lacks integrity. I mean, integrity meaning you live up to your values. So there's that, the wall of virtue, which means my disruptive ego states hit a wall of virtue, a wall of honor. I've made an a priori commitment that it doesn't get expressed. It pops down into the place where I work it through, and over time, I disable the angry habit, and you replace it with another habit, empathy, thoughtfulness, listening, working through, which means you can't just diminish the power of one ego state. You have to increase the power of a positive ego state. Now, I want to say to you guys, this does take time.
Sure.
It takes a lot of training. It's like martial arts.
Sure.
You got to get on the mat every day, train. And
can
then one
young
day,
people do it?
What's that?
Can young people do it?
Yeah, absolutely. They're the best. I mean, I was teaching this to my bar mitzvah kids. They were all over it.
Because one of the things we were talking about, that, you know, it's like that Paul Simon song, like I look back on all the crap I learned in high school.
Yeah.
And you know, my kids are sitting upstairs like learning cursive, yeah. You know?
Right, sorry.
But they learn nothing about like emotional management, about any of these things that far and away would have way more life benefit. Yeah. Have you ever thought about like, I mean, it feels like this is something that like in a high school curriculum of some kind would be immensely valuable, okay. But there's Thank nothing you. Like that out there.
So I taught a class called Parenting the Soul of the Child, right? I specifically teach parents not to raise their children for external outcomes, but parenting the soul of the child. What I say in this class is the greatest gift you can give your child is the gift of insight. Who am I? What's going on inside of me? And then the gift of virtue, how to manage what's going on inside of me, and the gift of working through. So what I say to parents, make this part of your family culture. When your family sits down to dinner, when your family goes on vacation, whatever your family's gonna talk about wisdom and virtue and inner life. Make it a fact.
Can you give us just sort of like a first day white belt kind of for wisdom and insight?
Well,
if you could wait an hour until my kids are home.
Okay. And we'll just... Well, so pedagogically, when I would have, let's say, bar mitzvah kids, 7th and 8th grade. Yeah. So I would say, have you ever made a mistake? Have you ever said something that you regret to a friend or your parents? So this is insight. Notice what I've done? Like, huh. Yes, I've said things I regret. I said, let me throw in their teasing. Because let's have an honest conversation. At a certain point, it's no longer fun, right? When it's done to you or done to another person. I said, what's going on there? I just wait. Something in me likes to be mean. Something in me takes pleasure in the pain of my sibling. Something in me likes to cause pain to my parents. It makes no sense. I just like to be defiant and disrespectful. I said, okay. Let's give it a name. So it's like Socratic method. It's not you, it's something in you. So we have an answer in Jewish spiritual psychology called the Yetzer Hara, destructive shape or destructive motivation. And then we work on naming it. So here's the interesting thing. From the insight practice, when you can name it, you can tame it. This is actually a kind of a meme in spiritual psychology. If you can see it, you don't have to be it. If you can name it, you can tame it. And this is one of the greatest gifts you give a child. Can you see it? Can you name it? So when your parents say something and this thing says defy, don't comply, disrespect, can you locate it? Can you say, ah, that's you talking? Mm-hmm. See, the minute they can identify the voice, and so then my next question is, do you want that voice to run your life? I mean, it's involuntary right now, but now you know it's there. Now you know what it does. Are you volunteering it? Do you want to make it part of your will? Do you want to will that up? Or do you realize there's something involuntary that's running your life? Now, this takes a while. This takes a couple hours. The kid says, there's something involuntary running my life, hurting people. That's true, Rabbi. Would you like to bring it under control? See, I got to get buy-in. You know, I had a remarkably successful session with a group of teenagers where I advertised a session is how to manage adults. Okay, so I had a bunch of kids show up. And I said, adults are simple. Like when you listen to what they want, they like do what I say, respect me. And you can typically get them to change their mind with this really interesting manipulation called respectful, rational conversation. You can take control of this thing. So I taught them how to get what you want from a parent. It's called rational, reasonable respect. You want to make a case? Make a case, right? Most parents are pretty impressed by a rational child. So the kids like were like, oh, wow, this is amazing. Calls from the parents, my kid has completely transformed. Kids are saying, I get to go to parties, right? Yeah, it's like win-win, right? But what I've had, you know, again, I need the kids in front of me. They need to be amenable. Not every kid is. But when they're realizing that reason, rationality, and virtue is in their long-term best interest, that's the start. I'm making a case from interest. Then as they grow, it's a case to honor. It's a case to authenticity. it's a case of living out your values.
My kids have a good start on the manipulation piece of it. They got to learn the other pieces of it.
Yeah. So look, they inherently want their way.
Yeah.
Right. And manipulation is as soon as human beings had language is what we do. But they have to have a moment and said, okay, let's look at that. The oftentimes manipulation is, I'm a step ahead of you, mom, dad. Like, I know your game. It's like jujitsu, right? You're a one-stripe white belt. I'm a three-stripe white belt. I'm always a step ahead of you. Whatever you say, I'm going to get ahead of you. And then you're going to escalate. We're going to have an argument, and I win. The minute you escalate, I, the kid, win because you've shown that you don't deserve respect. So the kid goes with their smile on their face. Just tap my parent out. They got mad. For them, it's a tap, right? So what about when the parent says, actually, I got a blue belt here. Let me see your little white belt game. And the kid goes, how did that happen that all of a sudden I'm respectful and thoughtful? What did they just do? You know, jiu-jitsu happens all the time. Like, you know, I'll sweep somebody, they'll go, how did you do that? I say, it's called knowing jiu-jitsu. Mm. It's like, not me, it's the game. So there's a certain part of it. I'll give you an example. So I teach classes online and people, so people just have these arguments with their kids. And I say, let them make their case. Let them make their case. Help them make their case. And then say, that's a really good case. Let me think about it. Don't argue with a child. Kid goes, what? You made a really good case. I'm going to go think about it. Can I get back to you tomorrow? Kids have never heard this. Because they expect the clash, right? Mm-hmm. Parent goes back and then they say, okay, what was my kid's case? Like, here's their facts. Here's their theories. Here's their evidence. It's a case. And you know the best things you can do for your kid? Teach them how to make a case. Say, can I help you make your case for you? Kid makes the case. Parent goes back. Now, if the kid's right, the kid's right. If the kid is not right, you got to demonstrate to the kid. It's not an argument from authority, right? When you talk about arguments, it's an argument to reason. And reason is available to everybody. So when you make an argument to authority, kids know it's a cheap shot. When you make an argument to reason, which governs the home, it's like it's the honor code of the home. Everybody here is virtuous and reasonable. When I'm not being virtuous and reasonable, you call me out. When you're not, I will gently call you out. Now, you have a higher threshold of respect when you call me out because I'm the parent. Okay? I will be respectful, but not as respectful as you have to be to me. And if you want me to explain that, I will. Okay? And kids, so no, we get it. Yeah, your mom, your dad, we're the kids. So I will be respectful, but you owe a little bit more on the respect side. Now, let me show you what reason and virtue is. I'm going to try to live by it, and I want you to live by it. So I've had parents take these fights where the parent gives them this speech, and the kid feels, wow, there's a whole other sheriff in town. Okay? And then calm, cool, virtue, rationality, make your case. And parent says, well, I don't want them to get their way. And what I say to the parent is, this is long game parenting. This is not winning the fight today to clean up their room. This is the goal of your kid being in respecting you for the till the day you die. Where they say, I have a parent of reason and wisdom that I can go to. They're not just bossy. They're not just dominant. They're not controlling. I actually respect their interiority as a human being. So you get a kid, you know, clean up your room. I don't want to. Make a case. I got so many other things going on. It's going to take me too long, and I got to do this, and I got to do that, and I really like doing, okay, so take a day off from cleaning your room. What? Well, you made a case. Parents says to me, but I want them to clean the room. I said, no, you don't. You want a child who trusts rational discourse. That's way important, because when they move out, the clean or unclean room is now moot. It doesn't matter. But if your kid's not talking to you, that will matter. Mm-hmm. So can you sacrifice an unclean room now and then? For a kid to say, oh, they respect me. I made a case, I won. Wow, this feels good. If you live according to what I call the parenting, the souls of the child, the possibility of estrangement goes down. That's one thing. I'm not saying it'll inevitable, but parents have gotten back to me. I'm less estranged from my child. So it comes down to a kind of a like to be a wise person eventually produces a methodology. And parents it's not taught to parents, not taught to kids.
We talked a little bit about everything that's happening with anti-Semitism in the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned something about really encouraging people not to overreact to moments in time, to individual sort of episodic events. And Kyrie Irving got his contract canceled by Nike. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't want to opine on Kyrie Irving's contract with Nike. I don't know that it really matters at the end of the day. But it did strike me as a little bit curious that, you know, this is a situation with a guy who, you know, you talk a lot about establishing fact patterns. So mm-hmm. in establishing a fact pattern, he tweeted about a movie and a book that had a lot of anti-Semitic stuff in it. I'm pretty convinced he never watched the movie or read the book. Mm-hmm. Then when he was asked about it, he kind of doubled down on it. And it took him a little while. Eventually, he did get out what seemed like a really authentic apology. Mm-hmm. And then weeks after that, Nike kind of cancels his contract. Mm-hmm. And it brought up all sorts of questions for me around okay. forgiveness, mm-hmm. around the labeling of people and things as anti-Semitic. Because to what you were saying before about not pushing too hard towards reactive moments to mm-hmm. individual events. Mm-hmm. I sort of thought we were done with Kyrie Irving and he had apologized and we were all moving on. And then I see that Nike cancels his contract. And I think to myself, like, maybe that's too much, you know?
Yeah. So I'm not their on-staff ethicist.
Yeah.
I mean, I have training in ethics, in both normative ethics, being an institutional ethicist, interpreting the ethical life, which is more what I majored in my graduate program. But let's say I run a company and someone has said something that's not just bad for the bottom line, but actually antithetical to how we understand our company. Like, yeah, we're making money, but we don't tolerate everything. And they looked at what this guy said and they said, he didn't do enough. Because when you think about forgiveness, there's also penitence. So the penitence to say, yeah, I was wrong. How much energy do you want to put into penitence, into repair? That's a very big theme in the Jewish tradition is when you wrong somebody, there has to be considerable effort in compensation. You have to change yourself. You have to show that you've changed yourself. You might have to be of service. Like, and from now, I will, number one, understand this Holocaust thing, understand these anti-Semitic tropes. I will really understand the best of my capacity, and I'll fight against the rest of my life. And I'll be a spokesperson for this stuff. Probably still have his contract, maybe not. But you see, there, when if a person were to deny slavery, let's say, and say, oh, slaves were blacks because they're not really full human beings, which was what, you know, white Southerners taught. And let's say I say that. He says, well, now you can't be the spokesman for our shoe company. And they convinced me that I was wrong. Well, I better do more than apologize. Like, I owe way more than, oh, I'm sorry, I was wrong. Because the damage I will have done by saying something like that, which was the line of Justice Taney in the Dred Scott decision, you know, why do you have to return the slave? Because they're not really human. Okay, that's in our history as Americans. That's a shameful stain in our history, and that's why I'm so in favor of everything we can do to work against that stain. We can't remove it, but we can work against it. So let's say someone says that, they can't just say sorry. Now, you look at the anti-Semitic tropes, that was a factor in the Holocaust. It really was. And it's not just that 6 million people died. I taught the Holocaust. It's not like it died in a war. It was something else. The amount of torture and degradation, the destruction of their human identity in a vicious, cynical, methodical way. So when someone says this stuff, I say, I don't think you have any idea what happened there. Most people don't, you know, they just don't. And like, as we were talking earlier, a wise person, when they opine about something, knows what they're talking about. So there are very few people committed to that. So they should learn about it and they should really learn about it deeply. So I don't know if Adidas should be so quick to forgive him because I don't know what kind of penitence he's done.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seemed like he took a lot of the meetings he was supposed to take. He met with the Anti-Defamation League. I guess it depends who's judging the penance, right?
Right. Totally.
You know, I wonder sometimes where, like, it's self-reinforcing in a way, right? It's like we tend to focus on the famous people, not the worst actors. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that does society like a disservice in a way.
Yeah. See, I'm not a trained sociologist, and if I were, I still don't know if I could answer your question and back it up. Right? So my expertise is in ethics, spirituality, these kinds of things. So I think I'm just trying to imagine Adidas that says, you can't speak for us and go to a bunch of meetings and thinks that this is removed. And the reason is when, what's his name again?
Kyrie Irving. It's actually Nike.
Okay, yeah. Nike. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. No worries.
Shows you how much I know about sports shoes.
Their shoes.
Yeah. Or this thing with Kanye West and so forth. Yeah. You see,
that was Adidas.
Yeah, yeah. I really think they haven't thought about it deeply. They're just saying stuff they've heard, and they're mad, and they throw stuff around. And so at what point does a person say, you know, you actually hit a wall? Unfortunately, you hit a line. You didn't know you're hitting a line. But now our culture is going to say to you, you've actually hit a line. You hit a wall. And now you got to deal with the fact that you came up against a moral boundary. Now, you're asking me when, where, how much, does it do more good and bad? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think I know what it means to enforce a moral boundary. You know my story of how my family became Jewish? You know what happened there? Oh, my dad was born Catholic. Left the church. My mother, he met my mother in World War II. She left the synagogue and they were leftists. They were Marxists. Mm. That was their religion. Mm. May of 1967, I see my mother very distraught, like breaking dishes when she's washing dishes. I said, Mom, what's going on? She says, they're getting ready to destroy Israel. If you go on YouTube and look at the Arab newsreels in 1967, it was not destroy Israel, kill the Jews. There were caricatures of Jewish skulls. There are caricatures of genocide in the Arab press in 1967, and newsreels, which were reported on American news. So I looked at it and said, what, that's about us? Yeah, and I never heard of the Holocaust in May of 1967. My mother sat down and said to me, you need to know about the Holocaust. My mother's family came from Lodz. Every Jew in Lodz was murdered. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm gonna get emotional here. When my dad was in the American Army, he was a medic in the 9th Air Force. They go into Germany and suddenly there's a call from medics. Like, we found something. You know, my dad told me what he saw. Now, they never told me about any of this, right? So I remember in June of 1967, like really terrified. Like, I didn't know I had a people. And when in 1 month I knew I had a people and they were gonna murder another few million of these people because I just found out about the Holocaust. That really embedded in me. That month, my parents says, remember when we told you that dad left the church, I left Judaism? Actually, you're having a bar mitzvah. In that month, June of 67, after the Six Days War. So I said, what's a bar mitzvah? I never heard of it. Never seen one. So back when I was growing up, my parents about a couple times a year would leave to LA on a Saturday morning and not tell us like that. We're going to a blah, blah, and came back. I didn't know what it was. For me, it was Saturday. They said, so my dad, like had not yet converted, said, well, there's a lot of Hebrew. You wear a hat, you don't smoke, and you park 2 blocks away. That's all I know. I swear that was my first introduction to Judaism class. I said, wait, so you want me to wear a little hat, do a lot of Hebrew, don't smoke, which you didn't anyway, and I don't drive. So I don't understand what you want me to do. And they said, okay, we're going to take you to a rabbi. He'll explain it to you. That was my introduction to Judaism. Okay. Wow. So they took me down there and here I am today.
Did your dad convert?
Yeah, yeah, proudly. My mother didn't want him to convert because she grew up in England with so much anti-Semitism. She said to my dad, why would we join this? I came to here to get away from that stuff. But my dad always hated anti-Semites. You know, he left the church because of anti-Semitism. He listened to the radio back in the 30s. His father, I forget what his name was, but some vile anti-Semite, was a Catholic priest. And my dad said, well, then if that's what
Coughlin,
right. Yeah. He heard Father Coughlin on the radio, that made my father leave the church. That's part of the thing I haven't talked about, what Judaism meant in my family. Mm. What it meant was, by the way, I wrote a letter to the Israeli consulate volunteering to work on a kibbutz. Because when I heard about the whole thing, I said, well, so who's working while the soldiers at the front lines? I said, can I go? They said, sure. Mm. So I wrote a letter to the Israeli consulate volunteering to go to Israel, work on a kibbutz in June 67. Wow. So I was all in. I was like, you know, I was all in. So that's a big part of it. So then for the Jewish military thing, I go to Israel summer of 1972 and I saw the guys. You know, they're the guys who fought for Israel in June of 67. Those were the guys, right? Yeah. So all of a sudden, like the idea of a Jew in a uniform with a weapon, Okay. So then my question at 18 really was, make Aliyah and serve in the IDF or serve here? Mm-hmm. So I thought the IDF has enough spiritual guys because of the draft system. Our military, you know, was such in a bad state in 1973 that I thought, I think our military needs guys like me more than Israel does. I'm speaking utterly seriously. If people say, why didn't you join the IDF? Because I think the American military needed me more than the IDF needed me. That's honest to God. I had many deep conversations when I was over in Okinawa, you know. Yeah, I think I made a difference.
Yeah.
I think wherever I went, people were glad I was there, glad they knew me. I thought about like the stuff we're talking about now. We didn't have podcasts, but we had talks, sure. You know. So yeah, I think people remember me. Like my, I have all the time in the world, right?
Yeah, yeah. You're good. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So I'm lying in my barracks, and this is in Okinawa. I'm in the 3rd Marine Division. I was a headquarters guy, so I was in headquarters company, and I'm reading Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago uh-huh. in my bunk. We call it the Iraq. So this guy walks down, big black guy walks down and says, what is that shit kicking hillbilly? You like you reading Solzhenitsyn. I said, so I got out of my bunk. I said, who are you calling a hillbilly? Blah, blah, blah. And so we started getting each other's face, right? But it was because, why are you reading that book? So then we talk later, and he's a highly intellectual black Muslim who joined the Marines for whatever reason. All the Percys joined the Marines, right? And I said to him, look, man, I'm not white. I'm Jewish. So he goes, okay, so I'm an Ishmaelite. You're descended from Isaac. So we are technically half brothers. This is what he says. He said, we can be friends. Because not like black and white. It's actually Ishmael and Isaac. Sure. I said, okay, so like, this was he trying to figure out how can I be friends with a white guy.
Yeah.
So we became close friends. And we were the two smartest guys in the entire 3rd Marine Division, according to ourselves.
There you go.
So we walked around, and then other people, like, what are you guys talking about? Colonial imperialism, Marxism. So his name was T. Cooper. Yeah. So T. Cooper and I, like, what would T have done without me? What I would have done without T? And all the other people dropped in on our conversations. So that was a real trip, you know? And, you know, we stayed friends for a while after, but yeah, I could tell you many more stories where people would say, "Oh, you read that book?" So, I was like the private first class rabbi of headquarters company, you know. And I don't know exactly what to do when people say fight anti-Semitism. I don't know exactly what that means. I really don't have a specific answer. I'm also very protective. I'm also very hurt. I'm hurt. I think these are human beings that are saying stuff, they're just throwing stuff out, and they don't know they're really hurting people. And it's scary because these are the kinds of things that were said that went somewhere else. I'm not a slippery slope guy. I'm not saying everything inevitably leads to something else. I don't want to say I don't want to be blasé about it. I just think I'd rather a person say, instead of I'm fearful, here's what I'm going to do. Because I've never found that being afraid going into a fight helps me fight.
So what are you going to do?
Okay, so first of all, I'm resolved. Here's the local things that I can do, right? So if guys at my jiu-jitsu club ask me, because they do, they said, I've had a guy ask me, what exactly is anti-Semitism? I had a guy in my club, first time ever, says, can I have a minute of your time? I say, I'm going to give you a 2-minute answer, and then we can talk outside the club. Now, every guy in the club knows that I'm Jewish, and I'm highly respected and admired in the club. And I think if anybody ever said anything, they'd probably hear about it. In fact, my coach, Chris Liscander, he's really protective of everybody.
Of course.
And if anybody did anything against anybody in the club, I mean, the honor of the club would be turned against it. And I've seen it happen. So I can do that. I can also, and this is going to be sound a bit self-serving as a rabbi, but I'll say it anyway. Our biggest danger is not anti-Semitism. Our biggest danger is Jews not caring about Judaism. Because 3 generations down the road, when we were maybe half our number now, it's not because of anti-Semitism. It's because people don't find this a meaningful path to their personal authenticity and growth as a human being. So my devotion is not the ADL, not the Anti-Defamation League, and so forth. My growth is to teach a version of Judaism where the person says, I am so glad I discovered this. It's the most meaningful thing in my life. It's a path to transformation. It's a path to wisdom. It's made everything about my life better. So I'm that guy.
There's so many Jewish people today, though, who say, like, I'm culturally Jewish.
Yeah.
What do you say to those people? Because I have the reason I ask is I had a friend who used to say, if everybody said they were a cultural Jew, three generations from now, there's no Jewish people left.
That's true. Yeah. I say, okay, so what's the culture? And they laugh, say, I'm a gastronomic Jew. I say, okay, so would you like me to respond?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I say. Would you like me to respond? I say, for someone who knows that, for example, from a normative level, not definitional, like Jewish food, normatively, what is Jewish culture? Let's especially speak about European American Jewish culture. For me, it's a culture of learning, most of all. Jews have a text. The text is central to Jewish culture. And mastering a text at one level requires a kind of intellectual training. That's a good thing. So it's a path of the mind, a mind yoga, to use Hindu language, okay, the Raja Yoga. It's also a path of the soul. So for example, when people say, I'm culturally Jewish, I light Hanukkah candles. What's the bracha? What's the blessing? Baruch atah Adonai. Blessed are you, God. Pause. What do you mean by you? You just said it. It's part of our culture, right? To say Baruch atah Adonai. You just said the word atah. To whom? To God. You want to talk about that? You want to talk about what it means to have a second person direct experience with God, where I'm saying you to the soul of the universe? Because that's part of our culture, where people took the word you to God seriously. And in our text, God speaks to people, all people. But we're talking about our text. God speaks to the souls of human beings. That's also part of our culture. So when a person says, I'm a cultural Jew, he usually reduces Judaism to a caricature. I said, okay, if that's how you want to go, that's like, I'm not in charge of the world. But if you want to know what I mean by Jewish culture, something rests deeply in it. And I'm looking at two real guys. You brought me on the real one, right? So you're real, I'm real. I guarantee you that a yoga of the mind, a yoga of the soul, a yoga of ethics make everybody better. Right, so that's what I teach. So when I think about Jewish survival, I'm sorry, these people, yeah, it's hurtful, but they're not the greatest danger to the continuity of the Jewish tradition. The greatest danger is boredom.
Hmm. Hmm. Is there something specific about this sort of anti-Semitism that's sort of exploding right now?
And for sure. Listen, every time you hear the Jews, right, that's an anti-Jewish trope. So when someone says the Jews, it's just back to this recrudescence of an old stereotype of the Jew. It's you gotta address it, but it's like addressing UFOs. Mm-hmm. I mean, you gotta talk about it because they believe in UFOs, but it's not it. It's something else. I'm gonna, you know, unlearned people repeating, you know, bigoted tropes, haven't thought about it. They get away with it in their echo chamber, and then they suddenly hit a wall. Right? So, yeah, I'm glad the wall's there. And then we're going to say, yeah, don't try anything physical. I just hope we don't lose interest. So we'll protect the borders. We'll protect the perimeter. But the main thing is what's happening at the heart. That's our struggle. So I just want to say, I get what's going on. I studied it. I taught it in college. Mm-hmm. That was my university professor. I taught the Holocaust class. But the rabbi inside of me says, we have a gift to give the world, a gift of depth and rigor and moral obligation. We have a real gift. So my concern is we're going to defend the perimeter and then let the thing go. Mm. You know, there are many people in my synagogue that are not Jewish. Mm-hmm. I get emails from people that says, I heard you on this podcast, that past, now including this podcast. Right. I love what you're teaching. Do I have to be Jewish to take your classes and come to your Saturday services? I said, absolutely not.
Right.
So I have many an undo. Do I have to convert? Absolutely not.
Right.
I'll tell you what the path is like. And if you like it, enjoy it. So I have many non-Jewish students, and they say to me, my life is profoundly enriched and nourished by what you teach. I would love to be, you know, part of the, you know, friends of the synagogue.
Sure.
Yeah, totally.
The story you told about your parents finally telling you about Judaism and telling you about the Holocaust and your family history, I do feel like, you know, at least for us, we grew up, we were fortunate enough to grow up in households where our parents talked to us about our family members, our generations that came before. They told us those stories. But I don't know if those stories get told as much anymore.
I agree with you.
And I think something really does die if you don't do that. That like rootedness, that connectedness, and that moment where you wake up and you know something that's deeper about yourself mm-hmm. than you ever could have thought of before.
Yes.
That doesn't come unless parents keep telling their kids the stories about their families. And I do worry a little bit that those stories aren't getting told.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you know, we commemorate Holocaust Memorial Day. We have a synagogue member, Stephen Greinberg, whose father's a survivor. And Stephen has organized a light a candle for a survivor. So you go online, you pick your survivor. You pick your victim. Like Fania Lebowitz, Warsaw, 1942, right? You light her candle. Then they give you information on her. So we encourage everybody in our community to go to his website, pick a victim of the Holocaust, someone whose name we know, light their personal candle, and study that person. I think that's a very holy thing. It's not just remember the Holocaust, but remember Fania, mm-hmm. you know, 22-year-old Jewish woman in Warsaw who got murdered by the Nazis. So like to personalize it. I completely agree with you. Now I'm going to say a but. So, you know, when I was growing up in the Compton Jewish Community Center, most of the adults were either military veterans or spouses of veterans and Holocaust survivors. I mean, people with blue ink on their arms. And our religious school director was a survivor. And that was, in a way, her Judaism is remember. And I remember thinking to myself, this can't be the essence of Judaism. The essence can't be the Holocaust. It has to be part of it. But the Holocaust is tragic for me, not just because of the people who got murdered and tortured. It's because a culture was destroyed. So I can remember Fania, but what was it like when Fania went to synagogue and she sang the songs and she studied the Torah? You see, Fania wasn't just a person who died. She was a fully embodied, cultural, learned Jew. Now, what are we going to do about that? So yes, we got to remember the Holocaust. But we have to remember it was a culture and a way of life and a religiosity that was destroyed. So, I want to defend the perimeter. You teach Holocaust for 10 years, you can't get the movies out of your head. So I can't be around Jews and not to think, well, they would have got you, they would have got you, they would have got, like, I don't like to tell people I think that. But everywhere I go, oh yeah, they would have got you too, and you, and you, and you. They would have got every one of us here. Okay? So that's what I think. I don't talk about it much. So in synagogue, when I see a room full of people, really wonderful people, my Holocaust professor would say, and they would have got you and you and you and you and you. I say, but here's my response to Hitler, a room full of Jews who love Judaism. That's my payback.
Thank you, man. Thank you. Thank you for doing this. It's really sure. been enlightening.
All right.
Special for us. You have anything for us? You have anything else you wanted to talk about? Are you okay?
No, I'm good. I'm good. Very deep, guys. Really appreciate it. Right, I mean, very real, as you know. I can see me getting a little bit emotional here. It's been a really, really deep experience for you guys, which is the highest compliment I can play.
I appreciate that.
Thanks for sharing with us.
Okay, guys. Really, really pleasure. So you guys have a... You in particular have exceeded your reputation, I gotta tell you.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
I
was told.
I like to keep that bar pretty low.
I told I was gonna like love you, but yeah. Yeah, there's that.